Listen to the voices of our world.
Wars today are so awful in their consequences for human beings that no cause can justify that kind of cruelty.
I am refusing orders to be an accomplice in what I consider an immoral, inhumane, and unconstitutional act, namely an offensive military mobilization in the Middle East.
I think that by the time this administration is done, it will have aroused the country against these policies.
Welcome to Voices of Our World, a presentation of this station and Maryknoll. Hi, I'm Casey Morabito, sitting in for Eileen Bott. If you hated history class when you were a kid, A, you're not alone, and B, your lessons went something like this. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Yep, you learned to parrot dates. Ken Burns' documentary on the Civil War may have changed your view of history, that beyond a dry string of dates, history can be our guide, our gauge, and a predictor. Sure, it can be incomplete, incorrect, or biased, but it speaks to us and allows us to find patterns of meaning that led us here to today. George Orwell wrote, "Whoever controls the past controls the future." If you know how things went wrong yesterday, you have an owner's manual that can help you to redirect tomorrow. Well, at present, enough has gone amiss that we might benefit by talking with one of the most highly regarded historians of our time, the author of 21 books, including Voices of a People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn.
I was born to two immigrants who knew why they were here.
A mom is standing at her kitchen counter, whipping up chocolate cake batter. Beside her on a step stool is her 3-year-old and very curious son. Mom has her oven preheating, dinner is cooking on the stovetop, and little Jack is waiting to lick a gooey spoon. Jack feels the heat rising from the stove and reaches toward a front burner to check it out. Now this is a crucial moment. Theoretically, a parent could allow that fateful reach and let the child learn the painful truth the hard way. But luckily, most of us had moms and dads whose love usually stood between us and the hard way. Of course, Jack's mom whisks his hand away, explains the danger, and then lets him lick the spoon. That scene has many parallels in life, including the whys and wherefores a responsible citizen might choose to protest an action made by his or her government. We've all heard the rationale, my country, right or wrong. Well, throughout history, some citizens have felt duty-bound to try to warn their government that it is headed in a wrong direction, to warn that the stovetop is hot. From the Boston Tea Party, to Vietnam, to the worldwide anti-war protests in February 2002, patriotism for some is the compulsion to protect one's government from a perceived hazardous course of action. But not since the Nixon administration with its enemies list has the United States White House been so reliable with meting out punishment to those who disagree. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill reported premature urging towards war with Iraq, out. National Security Chief Richard Clark asserted voluminous pre-9/11 warnings were ignored. Out. Ambassador Joe Wilson told the White House Iraq had not bought uranium from Niger to pursue reviving a nuclear weapons program. His CIA agent wife? Outed. Now, along with the Downing Street memo, the minutes of a Washington, D.C. July 23, 2002 meeting attended by Richard Dearlove, head of the British Foreign Intelligence Service, no less than 6 other corroborative British memoranda have surfaced. The overall import of the document supports that our current administration was bent on war and worked to make spotty intelligence back up their intent. When Congressman John Conyers organized a hearing on the subject, oddly only a small room in the basement of the cavernous Capitol building could accommodate the standing room only meeting. Renowned historian, co-author of Voices of a People's History of the United States, and lifelong social activist, Howard Zinn has been warning of hot stoves for a long time. Here's producer Kathy Golden with Howard Zinn.
We have the honor today of speaking with Howard Zinn, professor emeritus at Boston University. He's also a noted historian, author, playwright, activist. And which of those pleases you the most?
Which of those? Activist, I guess. And second historian. Last professor emeritus.
Gotcha. What drew you to the activism that you've upheld all your life?
I was an activist in the shipyard when I was 18, 19, 20, and organizing young workers. And then I suppose you can call being a bombardier being active, but in what later you suspect is not a good way. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, since the end of the Vietnam War, we've been involved in war after war after war. So I haven't had a chance not to be an activist.
I've been reading Voices of a People's History of the United States. I have it in front of me by Seven Stories Press, and your co-author,
Anthony Arno.
Yes.
Yes, Anthony and I, plus the publisher of Seven Stories Press, Dan Simon, the three of us decided that what was especially good about the people's history of the United States was those voices in it, those quotations in it from all fugitive slaves and rebellious women and working people and anti-war protesters. And so we decided to just produce a volume of those voices, of original material that could be used in classrooms and that people might enjoy reading and that might inspire them, we hope.
There's a lot of surprises in the book, including starting off with facsimiles of Christopher Columbus's diary.
Mm.
But I want to know, from your point of view, the overarching view of history that you in particular have, who are the voices we need to be listening to? Are they the people in the book? Are they the fellow activists all along?
Well, no, I think the people whose voices are most important to us today, you know, are people who struggled against great odds in launching social movements in situations that looked difficult or hopeless, and yet who succeeded and who saw the fruits of some of what they were doing. And I'm thinking of the voices of Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth and their cry for justice in the days of slavery. And they were doing this, of course, when the anti-slavery movement in the United States was very small. But then they persisted, and they saw the movement grow. And, you know, and a tiny anti-slavery movement of the 1830s became a national movement in the 1860s and had a powerful effect in causing Lincoln and Congress to begin to act against slavery. So, yes, voices like that of Frederick Douglass, voices like that of Helen Keller and Mark Twain speaking out against American imperialism and against war. Those are particularly important today, I think, in encouraging people today to speak out against the militarism of the United States and to know that these people who spoke out against it in the past, Helen Keller and Mark Twain and Eugene Debs, they're the kind of people who can become models for young people today instead of Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt and the generals whose military victories are often celebrated in our textbooks.
Let me read you something I found in your book just today. It's from a doctor, Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn. In her statement refusing to serve in the 1991 Gulf War, yeah. I am refusing orders to be an accomplice in what I consider an immoral, inhumane, and unconstitutional act, namely an offensive military mobilization in the Middle East.
Mm.
She goes on to talk about war for oil and things like that, and it is such a deja vu moment.
Mm.
If we were appropriately observers of the past, of our history, why are we doomed to be recidivists, if you will?
Mm. Well, you know, people are not the recidivists. The government is the recidivist. Because, as you say, it's deja vu. And the people who protested against the Gulf War, like the woman doctor that you just quoted, well, they're seeing their counterparts today because we, all of us, were not successful after the Gulf War in preventing the United States from going to war again as it just did, in first in Afghanistan and then Iraq. And the fact that we are now seeing once again military people refusing to go to war in Iraq as Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn did, simply indicates that we will not stop, that people who protest war will not be discouraged by the fact that our previous attempts to stop a war didn't do the trick. There have always been protests against war, and they will continue. And yes, only occasionally in history do they actually result in bringing a war to an end. I mean, the Vietnam War was a rare moment in American history when we created a movement against the war which became powerful enough to cause the government to rethink its staying in Vietnam. And you know, it's not easy to accomplish that. But I think the growth of the Vietnam movement is an inspiring example to tell us that, yes, it is possible when an anti-war movement becomes widespread enough, and when the government begins to sense that it cannot continue this war, that the population is withdrawing its consent, when we see that has happened before in history, as in Vietnam, we're encouraged to go on. And in fact, we are seeing right now more and more Americans turning against the war. And, you know, a lot of people are very discouraged because they see the power and ruthlessness of the Bush administration and its insistence on continuing the war in Iraq. Yes, when the war began, 70-75% of the American people supported the war in Iraq. Today, it's less than half, and it's moving in the direction more and more of opposing the war. And I think a certain point will be reached where the government, much as it wants to continue that war, will not be able to do so. It will not find the recruits. It will not find enough soldiers. There will be more desertions. There will be more refusal of service. Already, they're having a great difficulty in replacing the soldiers who come back from Iraq.
Yes, I'm aware. You yourself were a bombardier at one point in World War II.
Yeah.
In your own philosophical judgment, is there a good war, a just war? Can that be?
I don't think so. At one time I did, obviously, because I enlisted in the Air Force. And, you know, I saw that it was a war against fascism. Fascism was evil. And so, yes, I believed at that time that it was a just war. Today I make a distinction between a just cause and a just war. That is, a cause may be just. For instance, doing away with fascism may be just. Stopping some nation from invading another nation, that may be just. But does that mean that just cause should be turned into a just war? Does it mean that war is the solution for whatever there is? I don't believe that anymore. I think the nature of war today, being a massive and indiscriminate killing of people, the fact that wars today kill more civilians than soldiers by far. You know, at the time of World War II, it was a sort of 50-50 ratio between civilian and military dead. By the time of Vietnam, it had changed, and the ratio was like 5 civilians to 1 military. Today, the ratio is even more skewed than then. Wars today are basically wars against innocent people, against children. Of course, I should add that soldiers are innocent, too. And wars today are so awful in their consequences for human beings that no cause that I can think of can justify that kind of cruelty.
Do you believe you have the right to disagree with your government? Would you feel safe voicing your views? Email us. Go to www.maryknoll.org/voices. Just click on Contact Us or call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARY-KNOLL. You're listening to Voices of Our World.